How much time do you spend thinking about silk? If you're like most of us, it's not usually top of mind, but it turns out this material has a fascinating history and a compelling future, according to Arati Prasad, author of the new book, Silk, A World History. Arati is an honorary research fellow at University College London's Department of Genetics, Evolution, and Environment, and a writer, broadcaster, and researcher with a background in molecular genetics and bioarchaeology. Here she is to share five of her key insights.
My name is Arati Prasad. I'm a geneticist and bioarchaeologist by training, but I've always loved telling stories from deep in the archives of science and medicine. There are so many stories we don't often hear, some you really couldn't make up, but most have the ability to open our eyes to new perspectives. And those are the stories I love. It's the reason I wrote my new book, Silk, A World History. Researching it showed me time and time again that things are never quite as they seem, that even the tiniest animals are more incredible than we may imagine, and that there is so much we must learn from nature to give us the best chance of protecting our planet. When I first started thinking about silk, I had imagined only the most well-known Chinese silk. It was a silk with one source, one history, one road. It had intrigued me that its silk was probably the only material that has lived so long, remained in continuous use, that has been invented and reinvented. Here was an ancient material with a surprisingly technological future, a substance made by an insect to protect it from predators and disease. Yet, once in human hands, it became a material for the most luxurious of clothing and is now being tested for ingenious applications in medicine, technology, and as a sustainable material to help mitigate the planetary catastrophe we now face. Here are five of my favorite insights about silk, from its history and from its future. Insight one, the origins and ancient roots of silk. Chinese silk has always been the most well-known, so when I first started thinking about silk, I only thought of the celebrated cloth that comes from a moth known as the Bombyx mori. This Bombyx mori is a small, pale moth, which hasn't existed for that long in the greater scheme of things. Although genetic studies have been unable to validate exactly how old it is, just because we don't have enough data from the wild yet, by taking what studies there are, together with archaeological evidence, it's likely to be some 4,000 to 5,000 years old. And that's because it began life by being bred from a wild ancestor, the Bombyx mandarina moor. It was a rapidly flying, well-camouflaged insect, also known as a pest to farmers. But it produced a lovely, fine white silk. And so all those millennia ago, Neolithic farmers in the east of China bred it until it developed specific, valuable traits. In doing so, they created the world's only truly domesticated insect. That also meant that this little moth has also become very boring. It lost its natural camouflage. It can't fly. They're born blind. And they are completely dependent on humans to feed and to mate. These moths develop through a method called complete metamorphosis, and that means that the young, which are larvae, look nothing like their moth adult forms. First, the wriggling caterpillars hatch out of tiny eggs. Over some weeks, they eat copious amounts of white mulberry leaf, which is their favorite food, until they become very juicy caterpillars about 3 inches in length. And then they stop. They stop eating, and they stop moving. And that is a very precarious thing for a juicy little insect to do. It's at that point that they excrete liquid silk, made in glands along their bodies, that emerge via their salivary gland. When the silk liquid hits the air, it solidifies into a thread. In total, each caterpillar makes a continuous thread of around 0.5 miles in length. This thread is 1,000 times finer than a human hair, and yet it possesses incredible tensile strength. Insight 2. Moths don't make the only silk. The 18th century scientist René-Antoine Fauchelt de Réaumur once wrote, "Nature does not limit itself to a few examples, even of its most singular productions." Silk was one of those most singular productions, and Réaumur knew that well. He was a mathematician turned entomologist and was intrigued, in fact, by all of nature. It had become a particular fascination for scientists of his time to study the silk of spiders. In 1710, he was commissioned by the Paris Academy of Sciences to do just that. Spider silk was, and remains, the holy grail of silks by virtue of its incredible strength and elasticity. It is said that if a spider was the size of a human, the web it made would be strong enough to stop a jetliner in its path. But spiders do not, with good reason, like to cooperate with humans who want their silk. And this has been an eternal problem. In the last years, Professor Randy Lewis's lab at Utah State University sought to find ways around that, modifying bacteria, yeast, silk moths, and even goats to produce a kind of spider silk. In the latter case, the spider silk emerges when the goat was milked. But Raymond was also deep into the study of the anatomy of another animal. Known as the pinna nobilis, this is a Mediterranean mollusk, shaped like a fan that grows up to just over 3 feet in height. It narrows to a sharp point at its base and fans out into a semi-oval above, like a gigantic quill pen. At its sharp pointed base is a shock of long, fine filaments that look like locks of human hair, but up to 3 times finer. In shades of bronze or copper, golden yellow to brown, olive green to black. These threads also have an incredible property. They are self-healing. Known as sea silk, it was woven likely since very ancient times to make clothing. In the oldest remaining examples, the striking colors of their threads remain completely intact. Insight 3. Human innovation is global. We live in a world in which we have imbalanced ideas of where knowledge is created and by whom, what innovation is, and who innovates. But what quickly became clear to me, because silk is one great example that illustrates this, was that the knowledge and use of silk, in all its wonderful varieties, is a global story. Quite naturally, people everywhere had watched and studied their world in different ways and engaged with it to their benefit. Where there was an animal that made silk, those threads were used in interesting ways. But it's not always easy to find, in equal measure, the voices of all people, so that we might understand the history of their knowledge of and of their relationship with silk. We have European colonial writings on their discoveries, and the correspondence of Western men of science that allude to local peoples and their practices at the time at which those records were made. But there are few records from the local, or indeed from women's perspectives, left to piece together. Many indigenous women and men who informed the study of silk-producing animals in various ways remain nameless. Throughout the African continent, there were many animals that produced silk, from which its peoples produced prestigious fabrics. It was recorded in the 19th century that silks formed the embroidery on the flowing gowns of the Hausa people of West and Central Africa, in woven textiles of the Yorubas of Nigeria, woven of the beige silk cocoons of the Anafe moth, whose wings are crisscrossed like contrails, and which are also found in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Kenya, Malawi, South Africa, Tanzania, and Gambia. In the wild silk strips incorporated into wraps made and worn by Dogon women of Mali. And Madagascans had long loomed their own fabrics of silk, creations like the lamba, a cloth of a rectangular shape, used as a shroud for the dead. The silk of one particular moth was reserved for this purpose. It was, after all, famous for being rot-proof. But there were others too, including the Madagascan golden orb spider. The female, as large as the adult human hand, constructs great webs, complex discs around 5 feet in diameter, suspended by thick twine-like silk that looks like pure gold and stretches up to 26 feet across. And then, in the winter of 1935 to 1936, the first American archaeological expedition to India led an excavation of the Indus civilization site of Chanudharu, from which tiny beads of steatite were uncovered, lying inside a metal bowl. They are now at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. The beads had become fused together, but running through them were the intact remains of 40 or 50 strands of silk that some fine-fingered artisan had spun some 4,500 years ago. All had come from proteins assembled into strings inside the larvae of the large, wonderfully coloured, wild Satinidae family of moths. What is more, their threads had been extracted from the cocoons of moths of two or three distinct types, and from distant locations across the subcontinent. One type may have originated from the tropical west coast of India, with the other two certainly from Assam, more than 600 miles away from the ancient Indus cities of Sindh, and twice as far from those in Punjab. Here, out of the Indus, was another ancient Silk Road. And it will not have been the only one. Insight 4. Looking to nature for solutions. In the spring of 1221, Genghis Khan took the golden throne of Merv, a grand and learned city, today in Turkmenistan. He didn't just take it, of course. A contemporary count of the dead came in at more than 700,000 people. Of those who survived, some were intentionally kept alive. Among them were the city's artisans. Merv is likely to be the place from where Chinese silkworms were first taken to the West, after which great industries started in Italy and in France. Merv was famed for its silks. The fact that the city's artisans were spared may have had a significance beyond the spoils of war and the trappings of wealth, one upon which the very survival of Genghis Khan's warriors might have depended. All of his soldiers, all males older than 14 who were neither doctors nor priests, were provided with armour designed to keep them light enough to stay agile, and yet strong enough to return safely to the horde, to prevent casualties amongst their own. Breastplates and backplates of leather were sewn together like scales, with a leather-covered shield and helmet, usually made of much the same. Their outfit weighed nowhere near the 110 pounds or so of the iron mail worn by the European cavalry at that time, which put additional weight on their already burdened horses. Part of the reason the Mongols did not need chainmail was the way in which they fought, but partly it was down to what was under their leather armour, an undershirt, standard issue, of tightly woven Bombyx Mori silk. Nearly 700 years later, in the 1880s, in a frontier town called Tombstone, Dr. George Emery Goodfellow also noted the protective power of a Chinese silk handkerchief tucked into a breast pocket, not pierced by bullets at all, and that over the other items of clothing that outlaws commonly wore. Thick Mexican felt hats heavily embroidered with silver, inch-thick silver wire headbands, two heavy wool shirts, the classic blanket-lined canvas coat, plus a waistcoat. In 1893, this was followed by a silk bulletproof vest made by a Polish priest called Kazimierz Zeglin, based in Chicago, which was said to be owned by the German Emperor, the King of England, and the President of France, but which was certainly not worn by Archduke Franz Ferdinand or his wife on the day they were fatally shot, though it is said they may well have owned that armour too. In 2014, replicas of that silk vest Ferdinand might have had access to was made in England by the Royal Armouries to Zeglin's patent specifications. The ammunition and weapon were similar to those used by Franz Ferdinand's assassin, and it was amply demonstrated that the silken layers stopped the bullet in its tracks. Insight 5. Why we should learn from nature to help mitigate environmental destruction. The bewildering ingenuity of the animals that make silk and their distinct, extraordinary properties are of vital importance to future applications, because working out local solutions to the technological and environmental challenges we face has never been more vital. Silk is a natural, sustainable, biodegradable resource. That's true. Its ability to protect the body has long been known, not just as armour, but in surgery and for wound healing. At Tufts University in Boston, Professor Fiorenzo Omeneto's Silk Lab has also produced temperature-stabilized vaccines that require no refrigeration, penicillin that has been stabilized using silk for many months, and a chemotherapy drug that has also remained stable and fully functional at the Mayo Clinic for well over a decade. Another of their silk-based products is already approved for the reconstruction of vocal cords. As a natural animal protein, silk has the potential to work with the human body wonderfully. But more than that, in Omeneto's words, the fact that we start from a naturally based material drives us to put tech where tech normally doesn't go. And that really brings biology and technology together. That new space is a perfect place for silk-based innovations for protecting the planet to thrive. Keep in mind that the scourge of electronic waste may be even more pernicious than the impacts of plastic waste. That is perhaps more obvious, depending on where you live. And then, imagine electronics based on silk. These are already in development, along with human electronic interfaces, sensors, implantables or consumables to track health or fitness, or record vital signals. And silk-based plastics are a no-brainer. Emeritus Professor at the University of Oxford, Fritz von Rath, who has spent a career working with the silks of spiders, wild moths and other animals, including a small shrimp-like animal that spins a thread which in strength and in elasticity is somewhere between spider silk and the kind of cement barnacles use to affix themselves to ships' hulls. He reminded me of how nature tries to be as energy efficient as possible, while it has been humans who have catastrophically broken that mold. Because humans have now been making plastics for 100 years also means that science understands exactly how to make a plastic and therefore, potentially, how silk polymers can be constructed. It's an apt transition back to an ancient material, because although traditional plastics, which are synthetic polymers, have been enormously useful, their continued production from unsustainable hydrocarbons is increasingly unconscionable. It's in this kind of bigger picture problem solving that silk manipulating scientists see the real potential for the future of silk. What Omeneto describes as more profound social implications than anything that happens in American or European curiosity-driven research bubbles. And that is pertinent, because silk has never had only one source. And the animals that make it can be found in the wild, on nearly every continent.
Thank you, Arati. That was Arati Prasad with 5 Big Ideas from Silk, A World History. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.